You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, for younger workers, changing jobs multiple times may be the new normal. An expert tells us why more people are applying to jobs with plans to quit.
First, three women who have accused President Trump of sexual misconduct spoke out at a press conference today calling for a congressional investigation. Here's accuser Rachel Crooks during today's press conference.
I want to believe that as Americans, we can put aside our political inclinations and admit that some things, in fact, do transcend politics, that we will hold Mr. Trump to the same standard as Harvey Weinstein and the other men who were held accountable for their reprehensible behavior. Therefore, I ask that Congress put aside their party affiliations and investigate Mr. Trump's history of sexual misconduct.
Vanessa Tyson is an assistant professor at Scripps College, and she's with us now to talk about this press conference and a possible congressional investigation. Vanessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what did you make of today's press conference? And then the three women at the conference also spoke with Megyn Kelly about the same issues today.
You know, I found all three women very compelling in terms of their ability to detail their interactions with Donald Trump. With one case where, you know, the woman who was sitting next to the plane, next to Donald Trump on the plane, didn't realize who he was, only that, you know, he was groping her without her permission and without any kind of consent whatsoever. All three women seemed to show a demonstrable amount of bravery, particularly given the fact that they weren't asking anything for themselves. They were, you know, there was no identifiable benefit that they would have other than the fact that they wanted the truth to come out.
Now, the three women had shared their stories. This came out in the news before Election Day 2016. Theirs and a handful of other women, about a dozen-ish, depending on who's counting. Is something different now? The stories came out then. Are we going to take them more seriously now, given, as we heard there, Harvey Weinstein and all the stories that have broken over the last couple of months?
I think we've seen a tremendous increase in consciousness and awareness, particularly amongst sexual assault survivors. The reality is that so many women, and men for that matter, have been victims of sexual assault and sexual harassment in their day-to-day interactions. And that awareness that has kind of emerged both as, you know, in part with the election of Trump, but also with the consequent Women's March and any number of stories coming to light, is the fact that these experiences are not isolated events, that in fact they're patterns and they're trends that millions of people across the country have experienced in their day-to-day interactions.
Go ahead. Is there something significantly different between somebody in politics in this situation and anywhere else? We've seen a lot of people in the media, in entertainment, in business get fired for accusations like this. But for a politician, if they don't leave of their own volition, it's kind of hard to get them out of there until the next election day.
It truly is, and particularly if there are no criminal charges put forth. There's a longstanding joke that the way to get rid of a politician, or, you know, the most likely way, is that politicians step down or either retiring or passing away. That, you know, we have a legislature that is much older than, say, the average age of the American public. But politics is different in a number of ways. There's much more to do with a court of public opinion, I think, than there is necessarily to do with litigation and, you know, the desire to go to court on these matters. And what you see is a cadre of individuals who really are speaking truth to power, but also saying, look, we don't have to, it doesn't have to be this way. And the more that we speak up, right, the more that, you know, this is not the kind of politics that we want. And politics as usual is unacceptable, particularly when it comes to sexual assault.
We're talking to Vanessa Tyson from Scripps College, looking at today's press conference and interview. Three of the women who had accused Donald Trump of various kinds of sexual misconduct before his time running for office. They held a press conference, interviews today. I want to hear now from UN ambassador and former Republican Governor Nikki Haley. She was on Face the Nation on CBS yesterday talking to host John Dickerson. Here's a listen.
Women who accuse anyone should be heard. They should be heard and they should be dealt with. And I think we heard from them prior to the election. And I think any woman who has felt violated or felt mistreated in any way, they have every right to speak up.
And does the election mean that's a settled issue?
That's for the people to decide. I know that he was elected, but, you know, women should always feel comfortable coming forward, and we should all be willing to listen to them.
And responding there to the administration's line on this, including from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, that, well, the people judged this issue when they voted in Donald Trump. So what do you make of that back and forth of what we're hearing from the administration and from their appointee there, Nikki Haley?
Well, I certainly think that Nikki Haley is right that the women who are coming forward should be heard out. That is, I think, a beautiful part of, you know, the United States, is that victims shall have the right to speak up about their experiences. What I would say, however, is that, you know, the Trump administration has repeatedly kind of exercised patterns of abuses of power, as well as a willingness to impede investigations. So what I'm hoping to see is a dynamic where, even if, you know, an electorate is, you know, may decide that they want a certain person to represent them, and I would still argue that it's debatable whether or not, you know, Trump won a popular vote. He won the Electoral College vote. I think the issue becomes is whether or not we will stand for repeated abuses of power. Which I think is a kind of clear characterization of the current Trump administration.
Now, we saw Senator Al Franken in his case. There was a picture that really started the ball rolling. A woman released a picture of him apparently grabbing or reaching toward her breast while she was sleeping during a USO tour. Then since then, mm-hmm. we heard a lot of women come forward. He admitted sort of to a little bit of what was going on, and now he's resigned. Does it matter how much proof is out there? If a politician can just say, nope, didn't happen, and there's no proof to the contrary, is that it? We can't go any further from there?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think that that's the sole benefit that comes here. What I mean to say is that by women coming forward, it doesn't mean that that a politician is necessarily going to resign, or that he or she might resign, you know, subsequently, you know, in the future. But what we do know, however, is that the more women come forward and tell their stories and speak about their experiences, the more likely it is that voters have a better understanding and more information upon which to base their votes. So it's not necessarily something that the change happens overnight. In fact, rarely that's the case. Instead, what we see is that the change may happen incrementally as you find more corroborating evidence over time. And that corroborating evidence, in some cases, may simply be the fact that these stories in many cases mirror each other and show so much commonality that it's that you can determine a pattern upon which to make your own decisions as a voter. So while I'm not saying that Trump or Al Franken or whomever is or is not a sexual predator, what I am saying is that, you know, these patterns of behavior lend more information to the American public about who this person is and whether or not they abuse their celebrity status and the position that they have assumed.
We're talking to Vanessa Tyson from Scripps College now about the news that a few of the women accusing President Trump of sexual misconduct today are calling for Congress to investigate.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you think Congress should investigate allegations against the president? How do you think those allegations should be handled? The White House released a statement today saying these accusations were addressed before the election and the American people expressed their judgment with Trump's victory. Do you agree with that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're picking up our conversation now with Vanessa Tyson from Scripps College. We're talking about the press conference held by three of the women who have accused President Trump of sexual misconduct. These accusers are calling for an investigation into the allegations against the president.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think these allegations against the president should be investigated? Is something different now than it was before the election, after the Harvey Weinstein case and all the other cases of sexual harassment that have come out into the public eye and resignations and firings that have happened since then? Or do you agree with the president and his press secretary that the American people looked at this issue and absolved him, in effect, because he won the election? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Go right to our callers now. Daniel is with us in Toma. Daniel, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to know why, you know, you guys are trying to accuse the president. They should have brought it up before, but personally, I know a lot of women that use their body to also get ahead in life or use it to your advantage, and I'm not saying I've never groped a woman. I would never advance myself on a woman, and I don't see someone that remembers that you're on an airplane in 1974 and someone groped you. I mean, come on. What airline was available in 1974?
Gotcha, Daniel. So a couple points there. Why the women didn't come forward earlier, I guess, is one of the points Daniel was making.
And I think I can speak to that, at least. What I've noticed with survivors, and, you know, I helped found the Survivor Speakers Bureau for the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center back in 2002, is that usually you don't want to think about it, and usually it isn't a story that necessarily is going to carry much weight. In many cases, survivors and you know, as a byproduct of our society, our survivors are often told that, you know, through various implicit as well as explicit means, that they won't be believed, that unless you actually have the kind of evidence that police would want or lawyers would require, that you shouldn't come forward, that you should stay quiet. But the fact is that, you know, when we look at the numbers alone, just of the amount of sexual violence that happens in everyday interactions, the amount of sexual violence that happens on college campuses, you know, that it's not a reasonable expectation to assume that survivors have to immediately come forth. In many cases, it takes a great amount of time and energy and just will to try to process what they've been through, when the reality is that it would be so much easier and more desirable to forget.
We'll go next to Jim on the line in West Bend. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say something to your guest. I think probably a lot of women are probably afraid to come forward with, you know, very rich and powerful people, that those people are going to retaliate.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Go ahead, Vanessa.
Certainly. I mean, especially when you're dealing with, you know, someone with the likes of the power of Harvey Weinstein, the power of Donald Trump, and we've seen the kind of clout that they're willing to wield against those who would challenge them. It's certainly reasonable and rational to fear the kind of backlash and the kind of anger and animosity that these powerful men certainly have and are willing to use. For most of the women that I've worked with and some of the men that I've worked with who are sexual assault survivors, one thing that I've found repeatedly is that a case of believing that no one will actually believe them, right? As well as this perception that the system disproportionately benefits perpetrators of sexual violence and not those who come forward. So you may be subject to all sorts of legal ramifications. You may suffer, you know, from bias against women in the job, particularly if you come forward related to sexual harassment, and so on and so forth. And women disproportionately lack the kind of job security and financial security that allows them to exercise kind of basic levels of freedom when it comes to asserting themselves and talking about their experiences.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Kimberly with us in Escanaba, Michigan. Kimberly, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Kimberly?
Well, the fact that Trump had managed to get in office doesn't necessarily give him a free pass on the allegations, especially with the quantity of people who have come forward and the fact that he's on in a magazine admitting that he had grabbed women. He was on a radio shock jock station saying the same thing. And he was in a magazine also quoted as saying that he had grabbed women. And so I don't get the pass necessarily just because he made it to office.
And Kimberly, we heard, of course, the Access Hollywood tapes last year where he had described behavior that some of the victims coming forward, the alleged victims coming forward, said he did. And also, here's a listen, I think, to something you were referencing. Donald Trump in 2005 talking to Howard Stern about walking into the dressing room at beauty pageants that he was the owner of.
I'll go backstage before a show.
Yes.
And everyone's getting dressed and ready. And I'm allowed to go in because I'm the owner of the pageant, and therefore I'm inspecting it.
Is everyone okay?
You know, they're standing there with no clothes. Is everybody okay? And you see these incredible-looking women. And so I sort of get away with things like that.
So in both those cases, Vanessa, Donald Trump, now President Trump, describing the behavior that his accusers are accusing him of.
Certainly. I mean, you know, it seems like it's a pattern of abuse of power, but a pattern of clearly lecherous behavior. I think what's interesting as well is, you know, with reference to the Access Hollywood hot mic that he happened to be caught talking about this, you know, the dynamic of grabbing women by their genitalia, is this reality that he has since in more recent weeks, you know, tried to revise that history and saying that it wasn't really him on the tape. With Trump, you know, and with any elected official, you know, there's a dynamic of politics which is that you are offering to be a public servant, and in so doing, you know, these are the last people who deserve a free pass when it comes to sexual assault and sexual misconduct. In fact, these are the people who are voluntarily trying to lead our country, and I think they should be held to a much higher standard.
Vanessa Tyson is with us, assistant professor of politics at Scripps College, looking at accusations against Donald Trump of sexual misconduct. These were out, most of them before the election, getting another look with a press conference. Three of his accusers today saying Congress should investigate. Back to your calls now. Melissa is with us in Madison. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I'm really agreeing with your the guests you have, but just the fact that he is the president, doesn't give him a free pass. And I agree with her, like, he should be held even more accountable. And I feel like he spurred on all of this culture with his behavior before the election. We have the Women's March, you know, we're having all these women come out now because they feel like they have to now. And I feel like the current culture is really giving them, you know, they're seeing that people are actually being, you know, losing their jobs, or they're being punished in some way for what they're doing instead of it just being swept under the rug. And I feel like that's another reason why it's so important they're coming out now with all of these allegations.
Well, to respond to that, I don't know that I think Melissa used the term they have to, and I really think the fact is that they now can. And the reason why this is that, you know, so many survivors across the country are realizing that they're not alone. And while, you know, there's certainly tangent going around about not all men are sexual predators. Of course they're not. But the reality, however, is that there are so many sexual predators out there who are repeated offenders. Right. It's rarely is it just one person who they have trespassed against. In fact, you know, with Donald Trump, you know, we have over a dozen women who have come forward to talk about what they went through. With Harvey Weinstein, you're looking at literally scores of women coming forward about, you know, his sexually predatory behavior over the past three decades. So I think the reality that more and more women are coming forward precisely because they realize they aren't alone. And that's, I think, the overwhelming and overarching benefit even of this, of the Me Too movement, is this reality that women realize they're not alone. And the more they start talking about it, the more they put the pieces together and draw the connections that this is an epidemic. This is not simply their one isolated case. It didn't just happen to them. It happened to, you know, to millions of women across the country, and it's something that can be addressed. Right. If you don't talk, then other people, other survivors of this same sexual predator, may feel that they're alone and isolated when they're not.
Vanessa, briefly, as we wrap up, is this Me Too moment just a moment, or is this something that's going to, you think, create a lasting change?
It could be the former, but I'm guessing that it's the latter, that there will be lasting change related to awareness regarding sexual assault and sexual violence, sexual harassment. Whether we're talking about, you know, they're on dates, whether we're talking about on college campuses, whether we're talking about in the workplace, what we're seeing is, a consciousness that is raised, but also the fact that for those people who may not have been victims of sexual assault or sexual harassment, for those people who may never have preyed upon others, right? Now they're all of a sudden getting, you know, this overwhelming, you know, reality check that sexual assault is so prominent and so pervasive in this society. And I do believe that once you know, you can't not know, right? So this movement, it's not just a moment. It's a movement, and it's a movement that has power that will have long-lasting implications far beyond the 2018 elections and well into the future. And I hope that means that there will be significant change, particularly as my students enter the workplace.
Vanessa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Vanessa Tyson, Assistant Professor of Politics at Scripps College. She joined us to look at the press conference some of President Trump's accusers held today asking for a congressional investigation. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
You might have heard that a little movie called Star Wars opens this week. The Last Jedi is the latest in the series, and it got journalist Meg Jones thinking about Luke Skywalker and his connection to a Milwaukee Civil War hero.
The highly anticipated next installment of Star Wars hits theaters this month. Unlike the first movie in the reboot, launched 2 years ago, The Last Jedi is expected to feature way more screen time for Luke Skywalker, the lightsaber-wielding hero who might be based on a Civil War hero from Milwaukee. Some Star Wars fans will probably scoff at the idea that Darth Vader's son was inspired by a soldier who lost his father at a young age and left home to wage war in a land far, far away. But stick with me. Howard Bass Cushing was born in Milwaukee in 1838. He and his brothers spent part of their childhood in the Waukesha County community of Delafield, where a park is named after them. All of the Cushing boys answered the call to fight for the North in the Civil War, and one of his brothers was recently awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions at Gettysburg that helped repel Pickett's charge. After the Civil War, Howard Cushing fought Apaches in the 3rd Cavalry in Arizona and New Mexico. He was killed in an ambush in 1871. One of Cushing's fellow soldiers, a man named John G. Burke, called Cushing the bravest man he ever knew. Burke had earned a Medal of Honor during the Civil War and later wrote several popular books about serving with the U.S. Cavalry in the Southwest. 25 years later, a lonely soldier assigned to the same desolate outpost in Arizona where Cushing and Burke had served likely read some of Burke's books, including passages that described Cushing. That soldier was Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan. But before he dreamed up the Lord of the Jungle, Burroughs conceived a popular character named John Carter of Mars. Howard Cushing and John Carter of Mars share many similarities. Burroughs' description of John Carter is very similar to the description of Cushing in Burke's books. Both are recklessly brave Civil War veterans and Indian fighters. They're prospectors who discover minerals in Arizona and good marksmen at home on their horses. Which brings us to Flash Gordon. The creator of the 1930s comic strip and radio and film serials was influenced by the John Carter of Mars character. A decade later, a boy in California named George Lucas fell in love with Flash Gordon. Lucas even tried to buy the rights to make his own Flash Gordon movie, but couldn't afford the fee. So he decided to create his own space fantasy.
Take these two over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up for dinner.
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done. Now, come on, get to it.
Shortly before Star Wars was released in 1977, Lucas described his new movie as an adventure in space, just like John Carter of Mars. So, if Lucas said Star Wars was like John Carter of Mars, and John Carter was likely based on Milwaukee-born Civil War hero Howard Cushing, then I think you could say that Cushing could be the inspiration for Luke Skywalker.
Meg Jones is a journalist in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the workforce has changed dramatically in the last few decades. Some baby boomers might remember working at the same company for most of their careers or maybe their entire career.
According to a LinkedIn study, job hopping is the new normal for people under 32. Millennials are expected to change their jobs about four times after graduating from college.
Our next guest says the rise of the, quote, quitting economy says more about employers than about younger workers. Alana Gershon is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University and the author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. Alana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for talking with me.
So I feel like there is a fair amount of anxiety over the current state of the workplace. A lot of think pieces are coming out about how millennials are changing the landscape as it is right now. You know, how much, let's just put it out there, how much more likely are people to quit their jobs today than they were before?
I think people are strongly encouraged to do this. And I have to say that in my study, I didn't find this to be only the case for millennials. I did a survey of around 380 people who were over 45, and most of them have had over four jobs in the past 10 years.
So perhaps it's a little bit overblown with millennials, is what I'm hearing you say.
I think what I'm telling you is that employers are encouraging everyone to have this attitude.
And so what led to the rise of the quitting economy?
So what I think happened is that people began to pay much more attention to shareholder profit, and they began to try to imagine companies as being geared only towards providing for shareholders and no longer providing for a local community or for the workers that they have. And when you put that focus in, you need as flexible and fluid an employee, a workforce as possible, and you need to be able to fire people as easily as possible.
Okay, so we're talking about the sort of maybe a shift to looking to shareholders. For those of us who might not have ever worked in that sort of pre-quitting economy workforce, what did it used to look like?
People really tried to encourage company loyalty, and at the time, the argument in my book is that people also imagined what employment was like differently. So they imagined that they were, that they owned themselves as though they were property, and they were renting themselves for a particular period of time. And then in around the 1980s, there became a shift in how companies were viewing things, and also a shift in the metaphor. And people began to imagine themselves as though they were a business, that they were a bundle of skills and assets and relationships and qualities and experiences that they were consciously managing as though they were a business and constantly enhancing. And as a result, a employment contract was a business-to-business contract, and also a very temporary one.
And so are there any maybe drawbacks to this move of the sort of more inward, the me incorporated look versus the way it was, you know, maybe 30 years ago?
There are so many drawbacks. Where do I begin? There are drawbacks for the people who are working in this way because they live much more unstable lives. And there are drawbacks for the employers because they don't retain or nurture people who in their company who are repositories of knowledge, who know how things have gone 10 or 20 years ago and maybe have gone badly, and so that they can prevent those kinds of mistakes in the future.
We're talking to Alana Gershon right now. She is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University and the author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today. So I'm going to put it out on the table. I graduated from college in 2008, right when the Great Recession hit, kind of took the first job I could get because I feel like there was a fair amount of anxiety for people my age who thought that they might not be able to get a job. You know, we're the millennials. I'm going to just come out and say that that is what I am. Have been sort of tasked with being job hoppers at this point, or this belief that they're job hoppers. Do you think that there is some maybe anxiety from employers that people in a certain age bracket might not be around for a long time, and that might be exacerbating this?
Well, certainly where I was doing my research, which was in California, in kind of Northern California in the Bay Area, employers expected that. It wasn't something that they had anxiety about. They thought that this was how things worked. And they were also encouraging their employees to do that. And even managers were doing this. So managers would take employees out on their first week and say to them, well, I know you're not going to be at this job for very long, so let me help you get as many of the skills as you need in order to get the next job.
And so how would that benefit a manager then if they are going to have turnover in their workforce?
Well, the managers don't stay that long either.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know how it, I'm not quite sure how it benefits a manager for that, but I think that's now understood what it means to be a good manager. I mean, part of the problem with this system, of course, is that managers are constantly having to battle how they divide up tasks in the workplace in a new way, because people want to practice new skills and learn to do the jobs that are going to learn to do the skills and the tasks that are going to let them get a job at a next place. So they don't want to be too committed to the intellectual property of that company, and they don't necessarily want to do maintenance work that won't seem flashy enough for them to get a job somewhere else. And so managers have to kind of bribe the workers and tell them that they have their own best interests at heart as well, and that they are going to help them develop these new skills. I mean, that doesn't mean that that's, like, this is what managers say. I'm not sure that's what they always do. I just want to be clear about that. This is just now the language that people are using to understand what it means to work in an office.
Sure. So does it seem sort of, or maybe you can't answer this, but that there might be some talk versus how maybe there's an actual feeling, so not playing out the way that it's maybe coming out from managers?
That could be possible. I really studied the hiring ritual. So I'm basing this work on what other sociologists have discovered.
All right. Well, we are talking to Alana Gershon. She is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University, and we're looking at why companies today are seeing higher turnover.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you living in the quitting economy? Do you take a job with the assumption that you're only going to be there for a couple few years, or do you want a career, a company where you can go there out of high school or college or early on and maybe stay there, maybe till retirement? If you're on the other side of this, a manager or an owner of a business, what are you seeing from your employees? Do you want to see them stick around longer, or do you see them coming and going? And that's just the way it is. Well, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And of course, we'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing the conversation with Alana Gershon. She is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University and the author of the book Down and Out in the New Economy. We're looking at why more employees, especially younger employees, are moving to new jobs with more frequency.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have you moved from job to job a lot, out of choice, out of necessity? Would you rather stay in one place for a long time? And again, if you are on the other side as a manager, someone who hires people, do you expect high turnover? Would you like to see people stick around? What do you do to try to make that happen? Call 800-642-1234 or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page.
Now we're going to go to our callers right now. Derek in Eau Claire. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And what did you want to say?
I was just going to say that a lot of the employers out there, I just don't think are offering as much to the employees to make them stay at a particular job.
All right. Well, Derek, thank you so much for that call. So, Alana, there's a sort of a talk of incentives. Maybe benefits aren't as good at places. Maybe employees just don't expect as much. You know, how can employees, I guess, maybe work that to their advantage?
Well, I think part of what they're doing is by choosing the jobs that they're going to take with an eye to what the next job is, right? So when they're deciding what job they want to apply for, it's with a mind to quit already.
And do you see that maybe this leads to better salaries if they're maybe, I don't want to say resume padding a little bit, but if they're always kind of looking to the next thing?
Hopefully. I mean, the idea is that you cannot get decent raises at your own company, and so you're going to have to, in order to get the better raises, you have to move to the next job.
All right. Well, we're going to go to another caller, Ben in Wyawega. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And what'd you have to say?
I work for a factory. I do a lot of hiring, and one thing that I've noticed personally is with some of the younger millennials, I don't think they have a work ethic. I don't think they're coming from a place that maybe some of our parents came from where, you know, you're kind of told, you know, this is what you kind of should be doing. And I don't think they're following that path. We hire a lot of millennials and our turnover rate is quite high, and they don't want to do just the basic factory work. You know, they're always looking for something next. And that's something that we battle on a monthly basis.
Ben, thank you so much for that call. So we're hearing from Ben, who is a manager at a factory, mm-hmm. who's saying that what's actually something that they struggle with, that they don't have people that are willing to stay long term. I mean, maybe there are some sectors that this quitting economy might not really work for, it sounds like.
I think that's very insightful. And I think the question then becomes, can Ben at his factory begin to offer incentives that make it worthwhile to stay at the factory for longer? Is the job doing as much as it could do for the people who he's hiring?
Yeah, and I think that might be something that a lot of places are considering maybe moving forward, just if there is a bigger push to move to a more turnover-proof field, I guess. There might not be many. We're going to go back to our callers right now. Rhonda in Sheboygan. Hi, Rhonda.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if your guest, her opinion on the decline in unions resulting in a decline in wages and benefits, there's no incentive at a lot of these jobs, factory jobs, restaurants, wherever, with no unions. They're always looking for a better pay, better benefits. Why would you want to stay at a job that's not, you know, paying what you're worth?
Rhonda, thank you so much for that call. So Rhonda brings up this interesting point that, you know, maybe 50, 60 years ago, there was a stronger union influence in a lot of industries, maybe even in a factory setting, too. Do you see sort of that going hand in hand?
Absolutely. I think that this is part of what happens with the metaphor of everyone is a business, is that you stop seeing a division between the people who are the managers and the people who are the workers in such a way that you can argue with for strong unions. I think it's precisely the philosophy that underpins this metaphor that helped get rid of the unions in the United States and created this problem.
And so you're referring back to that sort of look at companies going more towards shareholders. And I believe that you actually wrote about an example of that with airline employees. Can you talk about that for just a quick second?
Oh, that was just a news item that happened this summer that really surprised me, that American Airlines wanted to pay their workers more because they were no longer giving them competitive salaries. And Wall Street had a fit about this. And their stock prices plummeted because Wall Street felt that American Airlines should only be putting money into the shareholder value, and paying staff was not the way to go.
And so that sounds as though sometimes that can be a weird decision for companies to make, that they can't please everyone, either their workforce or maybe their shareholders. So we're going to go back to our callers right now. We have Jeff in on Alaska. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
And Jeff, what did you have to say?
So I'm just wondering, I know that HR has been changing to try to adapt to the millennials entering the workforce, but do you think there's like any, for lack of a better term, reverse bias against some that are on the cusp of those ages? So like my example, I'm 35 and I apply for jobs and I'm qualified, but then I get a lowball offer from HR. And is there some of this, well, we're going to give them a low offer because we don't know if they're going to stay because they fit this quote-unquote definition of a millennial based on their age?
Well, thank you, Jeff, so much for that call. And I think there is a fair amount of anxiety over, you have millennials in the workforce, you have baby boomers in the workforce, you have Gen X in the workforce, and sort of navigating what some people see as ageism, that the older you get, the less employable you are, whereas you have younger workers who might not seem as though they want to stick around as much. You know, is there a balancing act there?
There's constantly a balancing act, but I really have to kind of wonder how many people are getting these lowball offers. They may just be giving lowball offers regardless of what the age is, to be quite honest. I mean, they're trying to get the cheapest worker that they can get.
Because it affects their bottom line if they can basically hire someone cheaper, sounds like.
Right.
So let's go to James in Oshkosh. Hi, James.
Hello.
What do you have to say, James?
My question kind of pertains to the idea that there's more transparency with wages nowadays. You can see what a given position through like Glassdoor.com
right.
might be from a bottom end to a top end, and then how that wage might progress if you stay in that job title or job for a while. And I think what some people are seeing is that you can stay in that job position for 2 to 10 years and your salary is only going to increase so much.
Right.
All right. So quick response, Lana, as we wrap up, what do you have to say to that?
I think that's part of what's encouraging the quitting economy. I think you're absolutely right that the problem is that in order to get a better salary, you're being encouraged by your company in a million different ways to find a job at another place.
Well, Alana, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was such a treat. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Alana Gershon is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University and the author of Down and Out in the New Economy, How People Find or Don't Find Work Today.